saving money on all your electrical needs at Menards. From wire, tools, testers, and more, Southwire is the perfect choice for your next electrical project. They offer innovative products to help you get your project done right. Hurry in today and save big on all Southwire products at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. Hello and welcome to the Undercut Podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jesse Billington, and we're back to review the second race of the Formula One season in 2024, the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix. When I say we, I'm joined by my co-driver and colleague, Ellie Mae Taylor. That is a throw forward to something that hasn't even happened yet, but there will be a reference that can be made from that in due time. Ellie Mae, how are you?
Stressed? Formula One is just...
The racing is meh, the action off track is really cooking.
It's just, every day you wake up with, not even wake up, there is just new news all the time. It's like the meme of like, what now?
Just, how can there still be more stuff? And speaking of more stuff, we ought to really dive into the news ahead of this episode before we actually get into the race review. Because, well, going into the race weekend, Red Bull suspended the complainant in the Christian Horner case. We believe it's always female worker at Red Bull, so suspended the woman that's sort of alleged this inappropriate behavior from Christian Horner. This, coupled with the Helmut Marko issues, there is a big power struggle going on in Red Bull at the moment. It is very interesting as you start to break down the proper politics of the team. But the Helmut Marko issues, the special advisor hinted to the media that he might be let go from the team. But then at one point in the weekend, he went on to tell Sky Germany that he'd be staying, which Max has pretty much deemed crucial to stay his staying at the team as well. Max has always sort of had Helmut as sort of a guide, a counselor, a sort of spiritual healer, essentially, sort of guiding him through how to get into F1 and make success of it. And he's sort of very much Max's sticking point at Red Bull. So I think Red Bull were almost sort of convinced that to try and keep Max, they needed to try and keep Marko. And they've had to start coming to some sort of resolution on all the other problems on top of this. So there's a lot of uncertainty kicking around the Red Bull paddock, and nothing's been truly confirmed yet as to who's staying when, for what, in what role, under what guise. But there's still rumours circulating that Horner might be gone ahead of the Australian Grand Prix. We just don't know.
I wouldn't rule anything out at this moment in time. I mean, it's alleged, isn't it, that Helmut Marko, the reason that was maybe potentially being suspended was because he was the one sort of leaking things.
Apparently, he's the one that leaked me the Google Drive. But, like, that man is a squillion years old. He doesn't know how to operate a Google Drive. Like, come on. Let's give the guy some credit in that regard. But there's so many questions and sort of theories swirling around just the Red Bull end of the paddock at the moment. It's hard to keep on track of, or keep on top of. It's hard to keep track of. And it's just baffling, the fact that there's not actually been any true clarity as to who's staying, who's going, who's done what. Everything's just currently sort of alleged or supposed or sort of rumour of this. For all we know, Duchess of Wales or Princess of Wales could be working as a pit manager or something in the Red Bull team. We just don't know.
I mean, at this point, it is just almost like one big civil war. But it's like, because there's so much speculation, it's almost like, how much of it do you know is true? How much of it is false and all of that? Because it's like, the media kept, you know, if you looked at certain outlets, was saying how Jos Verstappen wasn't at the race because of everything going on, but he was at a rally. Yeah. So he was never going to be here anyway. So
the source that we'd sort of used to get that just simply said he's not going to be in Australia in Saudi Arabia, and they specified because of the rift between sort of him and Red Bull. But and equally, there's been interviews with Max where he said that his sort of allegiance, if anything, goes with his family and sort of believing what his dad has said. And there's so many different sort of interviews and sides to it. Max had a relatively long press and media session going into this weekend's Grand Prix that was quite sort of foretelling, and a very different side to Max Verstappen compared to the one that sort of entered the sport and threatened to headbutt a journalist. It's worlds apart when we see what sort of how Max is dealing with it, which to say he's dealing with it is by and large staying up till 3 a.m. playing iRacing on Twitch. But that actually makes sense when you factor into the whole concept, time zones, and the way that the teams operate under the time zones for night races and so on. But it's, there's so much going on. It is getting tricky to try and unpick and sort of see what's a badly photoshopped image and what's the truth.
Yeah, and it's, even if you look at sort of Max Verstappen and then what Sergio Perez is saying, you know, you, it's different again. Sort of Sergio Perez has sort of, he has almost said his allegiance is with Christian Horner.
Mm. As has Daniel Ricciardo, who just sort of said the whole sort of, especially his, I think it was almost his reference to International Women's Day was just sort of a lot of noise about nothing, and it was sort of almost serving as a distraction, which isn't the sort of thing you want your driver to be saying when you're launching the second season of Formula One Academy on the weekend of International Women's Day.
No, and we can't, you can't call it noise when no one knows the facts.
Yeah.
Because this woman, you know, she could have a case that, well, we just don't know.
Yeah, she could have a case. She might not. It might be completely fraudulent. It might not.
Until, you have no idea.
Until the press, media, journalists such as you and I actually have an idea as to what's going on, we have to treat everything as just sort of, everything with suspicion, everything as possible. And that's it. It's just speculative at this point. So it's, there's very little point in sort of discussing too much further. But I mean, it's still not the only thing that's swirling around the paddock in suspicion. There's still the investigations going on into Mohammed Ben Sulayem around trying to alter the race result of the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix last year, as well as the trying to prevent the certification of the Las Vegas Grand Prix circuit, which is actually unrelated to the drain cover incident. That was simply a case of the drain below the road surface fractured, and that was what Carlos Sainz's car pulled up and ran over. That would have likely happened regardless of certification of the circuit. That's just concrete failing. You wouldn't have known that unless you sonographed every drain around the track. So there's a lot of investigations going on. It's not a great time for F1 publicly, and we'll get back to the public perception of F1 and certainly the way that it's viewed towards the end of our news section. But we'll move on to some of the good news story out of this weekend.
Yes, and I would say it's at least the biggest positive news to come out of, semi-positive in a way, out of this weekend. Depends who you are.
Yeah.
In the Oli Bierman replaced Carlos Sainz after he underwent surgery to remove his appendix due to appendicitis. Bierman becomes the first British driver to compete for Ferrari in nearly a quarter of a century, which ruins what would have been Hamilton's stat. He interestingly ran the number 38 on his car, and the last time that was used was by Mike Hawthorne in his Ferrari in the 1954 Spanish Grand Prix. Hawthorne would then go on to win the 1958 championship in a Ferrari, becoming the first British Formula One world champion. So,
what you're saying is the 2028 Formula One world championship will be won by Oli Bearman in a Ferrari?
I hope so. Maybe I'll put a bet on it early.
I'm sure Paddy Power can do you an acker on that, yeah.
It also means that Bearman is the third youngest F1 driver and the youngest Ferrari driver, 18 years and 310 days, meaning he would have never seen a Schumacher championship win and was born the same year Fernando Alonso won his first championship. I mean, I'm kind of unsure which is crazier, the fact that someone who was born in 2005 is now racing in Formula One or raced in Formula One, or that Fernando Alonso was racing alongside him this weekend.
There's so many great stats to it. Like, he's 2 months younger than the rebooted version of Doctor Who, which for me is just like a great piece of like pop culture statistic. And when Oli Bearman was born, literally the same day, Fernando Alonso was finishing second in his 56th F1 race. Bear in mind how few races there were in seasons back then. Like, you're talking sort of 12 to 15 races a season. So getting to 56 was quite a few years. That was like three and a bit years on the grid. So he'd already had a fairly long-ish career by any sort of Formula One standard. And then the next person he was going to race at a Grand Prix was being born that day. Like, no other sport really has you competing at a time when your next competitor is still being born. It's wild, especially the moment when they asked David Coulthard what he was doing on that day. And he went, oh, I think I was like coming in like eighth or something at the Spanish Grand Prix. And they go, yeah, that was the same day Oli Bearman was born. You could see him get very pallid and sort of ashamed of his age on the Channel 4 coverage.
Had the 97 championship been completed before you were born, or was it still going on? What's the closest race you've got?
1997 F1 Championship. I think I fall somewhere like the European Grand Prix or something that year. Let's see. Calendar. 12th of October, Japanese Grand Prix. So that fell 3 days after my birthday. So I would have been FP1, FP2, the Friday sessions, or Thursday session rather, because it would have been a Saturday race.
I think I was still summer break, but it was, I think it was the Hungarian Grand Prix, and then it was the infamous Spa 1998. So...
Yeah, so you're 1998, and this is the awkward part where I've got to try and remember the date of your birthday, which is the 5th of August. So let's see, calendar. 2nd of August, German Grand Prix. So then it goes Hungarian Grand Prix 16th, then the Belgian Grand Prix in 1998 on the 30th of August. It was that infamous Belgian Grand Prix.
Yes.
Where... Mika Häkkinen has pole position, Michael Schumacher fastest lap, and Damon Hill wins with Jordan Honda. What a time. The other interesting statistic about Ollie Bearman's debut, first British driver to score points on debut since Paul de Resta.
What was that, 2011?
You're testing my Paul de Resta knowledge now.
2012, 2013, something like that.
Paul de Resta had his Formula One debut in 2011.
Oh, I was right first time.
Yeah. 2011, and the first race of the season was the Australian Grand Prix, 27th of March. So technically the 2011 season hasn't kicked off for another 16 days yet. It was 2 weeks behind 2011. But yeah, that was... Paul de Resta, where he finished, be able to tell you, 10th and scored 1 point for the privilege.
Who was he driving for?
Force India, Mercedes. He was just behind Adrian Sutil, who scored 2 points. Mm. His teammate finished ahead of Jaime Alguersuari. There's a great name for pointless. Toro Rosso, Ferrari. Nick Heidfeld, Renault, Jarno Trulli, Lotus, Renault, and Jerome D'Ambrosio, another great pointless answer, Virgin Cosworth. Timo Glock, not classified, retired after nine laps down. Barrichello in the Williams retired. Rosberg in the Mercedes retired. Heikki Kovalainen, another good pointless answer. Lotus, Renault retired. Schumacher, Mercedes retired. Pastor Maldonado, Williams retired. And Sergio Perez and Kamui Kobayashi were disqualified for an illegal rear wing.
How many drivers actually finished that race?
14 were classified. But Jerome D'Ambrosio was four laps down. That's how bad the Virgin Cosworth was.
Oh dear.
Meanwhile, Sebastian Vettel was 22 seconds up the road in his Red Bull over Lewis Hamilton's McLaren Mercedes. Third place, though, you won't guess who it was. 2011 season. They drove for Renault, driver number 10.
I was going to say Romain Grosjean, but I don't think he was at Renault.
This would be their only podium.
Oh, God. Have a clue.
Their best finish at the 24 Hours of Le Mans is third twice in 2016 and 2019. First entry into F1 was 2010 at the Bahrain Grand Prix, and their last entry into F1 was 2012 at the Brazilian Grand Prix.
Nationality?
This might give it away, this might not. Russian.
Oh, I know. Sorokin?
No. The other Russian driver in F1. No, the other Russian driver in F1.
I don't know.
Vitaly Petrov.
Oh.
Yeah. Another great name for pointless. If you're looking for F1 drivers that scored a podium in the 2010s, Vitaly Petrov. There you go. Anyway, we've got completely sidetracked. Ollie Bearman, of course, replacing Carlos Sainz at the Saudi Arabian Grand Prix, and had a very good run of it. I'm sure we'll get to him in more detail when we actually review the race. There is a bit more news, though, including some from Audi, who've properly cemented their plans for 2026, having announced they'll be buying out 100% of Sauber ahead of the 2026 season. Andreas Seidel will be CEO of the team and the face of the future Audi Formula One team. And they have confirmed they will have their own power unit for the 2026 season. So this is a big move for Audi, and obviously Volkswagen is probably going to be their big backers. So this is the end of Sauber as we know it. Sauber will be gone.
If I'm honest, I can't wait, as I'm hoping Audi will actually sort of bring a competitive car. It kind of...
The Sauber at the moment isn't uncompetitive. The problem they seem to have is wheel nuts.
Yeah, that's true. It's not uncompetitive, but it's not really competitive either. I mean, Alfa Romeo kind of came in and just were there. I mean, you've got to look at their like previous history of when, you know, back in, I mean, we're going far, far back now, you know, when they were just sort of joining the 50s and all that. They were such a successful team and they just sort of came in and...
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Well, like, we're almost using F1 to promote the fact that we want more cars to be sold, but we're not going to be very competitive in this.
Yeah. Like, sort of when Alfa Romeo joined, I think they joined more as a title sponsor than as, like, a technical sponsor. But obviously, Sauber used to be good in the noughties, the 90s, the noughties, the early 2010s, like the old sort of BMW Saubers and all that. They were great cars. But then they just sort of flopped and fell off a bit at the same time that Williams did, interestingly. There was sort of a technical shift and they weren't able to keep pace with it. And we sort of saw the emergence of big backmarkers like Williams and Sauber, which was quite strange. But this sort of heralds a new era from them. We've obviously heard previously that Audi have got test engines up and running. They've got single-cylinder, four-cylinder versions working at the compression and power outputs that they're expecting. So it's promising signs. They've got a big sort of proper technical manufacturer behind them. They've got the funding might of Volkswagen as well. Obviously, it's going to be run as Audi because you're going to use one of your sort of high performance sort of luxury brands if you're entering the world of Formula One. You don't simply enter the Skoda Formula One team, as funny as that might seem as a concept. So obviously Audi makes sense for sort of Volkswagen's sort of brand to enter in. I think once they knew that they'd got a set plan with Audi, they might have pulled the plug on the Porsche deal to avoid having too much competing technology. But yeah, it's interesting from a sort of future standpoint, but a bit of a shame to be losing Sauber as a name, I think, because it has had some good moments. When it comes to sort of F1, they're taking over Sauber, who obviously BMW factory team, really good. Nick Heidfeld, podium finish in 2006, to name sort of one of them. I'm fairly certain that Robert Kubica got one of his podiums with a Sauber at one point. There was a win, wasn't it? It was his only win in Canada, 2008. I think that was one of the other actual standout things of the 2008 season, was Kubica winning the Canadian Grand Prix in a Sauber. So it's a team that's got good history. It was the team that first brought Red Bull into F1 as well, back in the 90s, I want to say, when they had Ford engines. So it's, yeah, it's a really interesting team, and it's a shame to see it getting bought out, but at the same time, it's nice to have big technical money of Audi.
Yeah, I think it's needed. It's almost one of those cases that, you know, you get sad that, you know, a team's being bought out. You know, you look at some of like, the historical names that have been bought out, and like, you know, Lotus.
Mm.
But it's like, sometimes it's just time.
Or the Williams family stepping back from Williams when they got bought out by Doralton Capital. But then you look at the step forward that Williams as a team has been able to make since then, you could argue that it's been for the greater good. So, yeah. Speaking of teams that have made a bit of a step forward, Aston Martin are still sort of surging onwards technically, but they've had some good stuff actually happen across this weekend.
Yes, Aston Martin staged their first ever demo run with an F1 car in Saudi Arabia ahead of the Grand Prix weekend with their head of racing for F1 Academy and driver ambassador, it's a really long name, Jess Hawkins, which means she's now become the first woman to drive the current generation of F1 cars, whilst obviously not seeing this in a competitive session or a free practice session, we have to remember that women weren't even allowed to drive in Saudi Arabia until 2018. So this is still a big statement. And when you couple that with the fact that F1 Academy raced here this weekend and with sort of our next point, it's still fairly big.
It's a great milestone to hit. And it's sort of Aston Martin making a good show of the talent they've got and equally sort of going, well, that's a milestone no one's thought to do yet. Like, people have done show drives and test demos with the current iteration of cars, but no one's thought to go, you there, Jamie Chadwick, you're not doing anything. Get in this here, Williams. So making Jess Hawkins, not making Jess Hawkins doing it, but sort of utilizing Jess Hawkins at the right point in time in the calendar to do this was a great bit of marketing from them, but also I hope that it leads to a bit more from Jess Hawkins across the year. I think she's going back to GT racing this year. I think she's got that on her calendar, as well as obviously running the F1 Academy side with Tina Housman. Felipe Massa has filed a lawsuit against the FIA, Formula One Media, and Bernie Eccleston over the 2008 Singapore Grand Prix crashgate scandal. We mentioned 2008 earlier, talking about Kubica and the Canadian Grand Prix. Of course, Alonso also won two races that year, one of which was the Singapore Grand Prix off the back of Crashgate, where, for younger listeners that don't know, Renault essentially organised for Alonso's teammate Nelson Piquet Jr. to sort of lob his Renault R28 into the wall at a tricky-to-recover point around the Marina Bay circuit, the idea being that it would cause a prolonged safety car, giving Fernando a chance to pit. They would obviously know when it's happening, so they could prepare appropriately for this pit and fuel strategy and give Alonso the advantage. This was quickly found out. I think Piquet sort of blew the whistle on it himself to a certain extent, sort of unveiling the whole plan and going, yeah, I'm not going to stay quiet about this. Lots of people were banned from Formula One for this, including Flavio Briatore, the leader of Renault at the time. But anyway, it was a bit of a chaotic race, and ultimately, at one point, I don't think Massa was going to be in with good running, because he pulled away from one of his pit stops with the fuel hose still attached. There was a great shot of him traveling down the fast lane of the pits with the fuel hose dangling behind him. It's sort of torn off from its mount. Big problem there. So it was not really a race that was going Massa's way. But he has asked in London High Court that the race just be discounted from the season, just so scratch it from the list. And you're going, well, just because that's the one race that was sort of corrupted in a way that didn't really affect you, can you ask for that? And it raises a lot of interesting questions. Certainly the statute of limitations when it comes to older races, how far back can you go to change the results? This race is, does the mental math, 16 years ago. From what I can see, they're expecting it to sort of be cancelled. And if you do that, the results for the championship are actually quite interesting. Massa would win it, 97 points. Second, he would have finished second in reality. Hamilton would have finished on 92 points in second place. Raikkonen unchanged, 75, third. Kubica, 75, fourth. Nick Heidfeld would move up to fifth place from sixth. Heikki Kovalainen would move up from seventh place to sixth. And Fernando Alonso, obviously now devoid of his 10 points for a win, would drop to seventh from fifth place. Vettel and Trulli stayed in the same place, eighth and ninth, now tied on 31 points. Mark Webber moves up one place to 10th with 21 points. Timo Glock in 11th on 20 points. Piquet Jr. scores 19 in 12th. Barrichello 13th, up one from 14th. Rosberg drops one to 14th, on now on 9 points. Coulthard moves up one to 15th, and Nakajima down one. Then after that, it's Bourdais, Button, Fisichella, Surtil, rounding out the 20 drivers. The constructors wouldn't change order. So this feels like grabbing at straws, but nearly two decades too late.
I'll firstly say what Timo had to say about it, as he sent me a voice note, which I opened up with, crisis. We didn't already have enough going on with Formula One at the moment, which has a point. Timo believes that they should just pay him off but don't overturn the championship, as it brings the sport into a whole new level of who. I inserted the PD version of that.
Yeah.
And it sort of begs the question of why should you watch F1 if someone then can get a result overturned, even when it wasn't, you know, Hamilton's fault.
Yeah.
I think arguing that he would have scored points in that race if it wasn't for that is obviously flawed. You can't say for certain what the outcome of that race would be. For all we know, Massa himself could have crashed the car, it could have broken down, anything could have happened. And I think the courts will completely dismiss that. I think he has brought it to the UK court. So I think part of the British sort of unwritten constitution that we have, if I remember this correctly, is that when we're sort of setting a precedent, one of the questions that's asked is sort of, would the conclusion that they've come to open up the floodgates, i.e. if they allow for this race to be voided and this meaning the championship result gets changed, will this sort of, you know, open up the floodgate to many other situations coming to court? You know, what's then stopping Hamilton to bring a case of
what happened in 2021?
I'd like to perhaps know more details about this. Obviously, it's sort of kind of breaking and we don't know too much about all the details of it. But, and I know kind of what I'm thinking, but I can't, it's hard to convey into words, but my understanding is that he's not almost trying to get the championship overturned as such. I think what he wants is basically damages for improper handling of the situation. And he's arguing that Bernie Eccleston and those high up knew more than they let on and pretty much just tried to cover it up.
Mm-hmm.
I think ultimately, I've gone back and forth over this. I think at the time, the race in a way should have been voided. The race result is as a result of outside human intervention, and it was fixed. It was pre-planned that Nelson Piquet Jr. would crash so Fernando could win the race. This might kind of be a bad example, but, you know, if an athlete has been found to have been taking something that is against the regulations, you know, they're taking substances, they get disqualified. Even if the medal ceremony and all that has taken place, they get disqualified and everyone behind them moves up one place. And, you know, another medal ceremony is given if that person happened to be on the podium. But in this case, I don't necessarily think the championship outcome should change as a result. I think it's too
far gone to change the entire championship. In things like sort of cycling races, if you'd sort of you keep going with like the doping allegations or sort of the Olympics, where if you have that sort of thing come to light, yeah, you change the results. But this doesn't change an overall championship or the way things are done. With F1, because if you change one race, it impacts an entire championship. And we've seen here that it impacts the championship all the way down to as low as 16th place. And while it doesn't change the constructors, it hugely impacts the driver standings. But equally, there has to be a line drawn in the sand as to when you can go back and change the result of a race. I think there has to be a line drawn at some point going, look, after 2 years, tough. You haven't been able to put it together. You haven't been able to get an argument or a case put together. 2 years has passed. That is ratified. We cannot change that. In this instance, I think you're right in saying the race should have been abandoned at that point. It should have been struck from the records in period. In 2008, they should have gotten to sort of two races, or when this came out, they should have gone, no, sorry, that cannot stand. Like, how soon after did it come out? I can't remember.
No, I was trying to think that as well, because I think as well, part of it depends on the timeline as to when this evidence was found that this was a fix, because, you know, if the F1 management knew about it and didn't do anything on purpose, because I think there's a rule that once a championship ceremony has taken place, the results cannot be changed.
Mm.
So,
which could be why on August 30th, 2009, reports by the Brazilian television station Rede Globo stated that Piquet Jr. had been ordered to crash. So it all started to come out a year down the line, essentially about a year later, which sort of comes up to the point where the F1 result is ratified. And I think at that point, once they knew and had the results, they should have struck it from the record books. They should have been gone there and then.
Yeah, and I think it's the improper handling of it all that I'm like, should Massa be given damages? Should he not? Technically, he's not Formula One world champion as a result.
Mm.
But at the same time, there's so many other factors that could have played a role that...
Yeah, I think he's realised that what he needs to argue is for the race to be struck from that season, as opposed to sort of him just given the championship. That's the way for him to earn the championship, that race has to be struck. And you could argue that the race itself was not purely that race. It had, obviously, like you said, the human intervention, the outside factors weighing into it. The argument he makes sense, but the problem is he's making it a decade and a half plus too late.
Yeah.
It should have been made as soon as that happened. I think he might get away with settlements because the compensation he's seeking is worth somewhere between 60 and 150 million pounds. So I think it's being settled in pounds because obviously British court. So I think he could walk away relatively happy from that, but it's still gonna grate a bit.
Yeah, I think that's basically what he wants. I think he just wants damages. I don't think he wants...
But at this point, he's given up on chasing that championship.
Yeah, he just wants to be, awarded damages.
Yeah, which I think at this point is quite fair. And certainly Formula One and Eccleston could settle for 60 to 150 million. That's pocket change for Bernie Eccleston. And these days, that's pocket change for Formula One as well. We'll see what happens with that one. We'll keep our legal eagle, Ellie Mae, pointed at that one to see what happens. In the meantime, though, before we move into the actual race, and this does relatively sort of lead towards it, is... I want to ask a big question. Is Formula One losing its flair as a spectator sport? And this weekend, you've got to bear in mind that certainly in the UK, it was up against football. There were football matches in the FA Cup, I want to say. There was the Six Nations Big Rugby. One. Yeah, there was Six Nations Rugby and Rugby League kicking around, plus obviously other sports around the country. And later this year, it's going to be up against the Olympics. It's going to be vying for viewing figures for one of the world's largest sporting events. With the level of domination we're seeing from Red Bull, the front end of races is fast looking like a foregone conclusion every weekend. So will we start to see viewing figures slip? And this sort of gets more interesting as a question when you sort of factor in the spread of sprints that's on this year's calendar. There's an increased level of investment the sport asks.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
From its fans and for a seemingly less reward. Like, even if you, for a standard Grand Prix weekend, even if you only watch qualifying and the race, that's still at least 3 hours of your time you're being asked to spend on it, only to get a result you could have easily guessed. With football and rugby matches, it's rare to know the complete outcome of a match before it starts. Like, you can probably guess if it's going to be something like Manchester United versus Luton, that it's going to be pretty much a domination from Manchester United as much as I'd like it the other way around. But you see interesting play happen, and then you watch another match. With F1, you sort of go, we'll sort of know what's going to happen. There's going to be some overtakes, probably a few retirements from the slightly worse off teams, and it's sort of starting to get copy-paste. And the spectacle of F1 is arguably getting worse. The fees that you're having to pay to watch it, certainly in the UK, to watch it on things like Sky Sports or F1 TV, are getting higher and higher, as are ticket costs to go along and see it. And the fan experience is, as far as I'm aware, not getting any better. Is it losing its flair as a spectator sport, or is it simply going to be something that we just watch as a highlights package?
It's a tough question. I think obviously these regulations, we were meant to have closer racing in some respects. We do, if you take out Red Bull. And I mean, you've got the argument that domination has always kind of happened. Even if you look at something like, take football, for instance, you get certain teams that dominate for a while and then another comes along. Like at the minute, you know, Man City have won three previous of the Premier Leagues, I think. But it used to be that out of City and Man United, United used to be the dominant team. And to some extent, you know, there is sort of a form of domination from a team in many various sports. And, you know, sometimes you get an off day where that team you expect to win doesn't. But going back to F1, you know, obviously domination used to come from Mercedes. You go back further and look at Ferrari in the early 2000s. They won all but two races in 2002. Mm. It just so happens at the moment it's Red Bull, and it depends how you want to look at it. You can look at it as boring, or you can kind of look at it as impressive. You can applaud how in such a long season we have Verstappen almost every weekend is at the top of his game consistently, and to always see how switched on he is, how even when he undoubtedly was going to win that championship last year, he was still frustrated in his performance at Singapore. He always strives to be the best and not take a single race for granted. For me, that's such an impressive mindset to have. And you can also then be impressed at how, you know, Red Bull have created this mighty, fast, reliable car. I think it all depends on how you want to look at it. Yes, sometimes races can be a bit stagnant, but do you always have a good rugby match? Do you always have a good football match?
I think with a football match or a rugby match, there's always the chance that it will go another way. And with F1 at the moment, we're just not seeing that. Like, you look at the reliability or the consistency, like you said, from teams last year, and we're seeing that carry over into this year. I like the way you, essentially you answered it in the same way that I would, but which is what it gives me a chance to sort of play that devil's advocate in a way and go, but against these bigger things that are coming up, against things like the Olympics, are we likely going to see a drop off in viewing figures this year? And almost, can we predict if F1 are going to try and make an even bigger spectacle of itself just to try and retain viewers? Like, we've got the longest calendar the sport's ever seen, 24 races this year. And we're like, yeah, that's great, but are you feeling excited for any of them, honestly?
I don't know.
I'm going to leave the pause in there as well, because that's just as telling as the actual answer. Because I love F1 as much as the next person, assuming the next person is, I don't know, maybe Charles Leclerc at the moment. I'm struggling to even think of a driver that really enjoys the season, because they're all going into every race knowing Verstappen's winning. Russell said it as much coming out of Bahrain. Like, there's still the drive for the drive. Each individual driver still has a drive to do well in and of themselves, but they know what the race result is going to be before it happens. We were talking about race fixing literally the question before this. We're almost beyond that point where it's fixed because of the nature of the sport, the nature of the beast.
Don't get me wrong, I love this sport, and it's maybe excitement. Do I get excited? Maybe not, but maybe that's because there are so many races. It's kind of like, I guess because I always know there's another one. It's, I don't know, like, okay, Saudi Arabia, I was still stressed throughout the whole entire thing, and it's like, if I didn't love the sport, then I wouldn't have had that emotion in me. And I think, you know, it's still, despite almost knowing who would win it, it still brings emotion. I still love to watch it. I still love to look at the analysis of everything, you know, even if it is just fire chat. I am with Bernie Collins on this. I love a tire chat. And I'm almost kind of at the stance of no one's forcing anyone to watch anything. If you don't like it, don't watch it.
So from what you're saying, and again, this is great because I agree with it, is F1 is almost sliding back to being a sport for proper diehard, dyed-in-the-wool F1 fans. Like the ones that will tune in each week to watch tire degradation. And I like that. I like the fact that the sport has inadvertently undone all of its hard work with Drive to Survive to go, we're about to serve you up for the most boring 2 hours, unless you like the intricacies of pull rod suspension, in which case, buckle up, boyo. And it's strange that that's the way it's panned out. It's put so much time and effort into going, aren't we the most amazing traveling circus you've ever seen? Look at our boys catch fire and go 200 miles an hour. And then they go, and here's a man with a very large brain. He's going to explain to you how he designed a car without using a wind tunnel. And you're going to go, oh, I find that interesting. And the sport rolls on. It's just interesting. I'm dying to see the viewing figures come the end of the Paris Olympics. I think that will be a hugely telling point for how well the sport's able to sustain its viewership figures. Like year on year, they've gone, oh, it's grown. I think last year they did see a dip. It'll be interesting to see how big that dip is this year. our review of the Grand Prix itself. And we'll kick off with the dominant team, Red Bull. And Timo's notes on the spread, he's not here tonight, I can't remember what he's up to, but his notes on the spread are no notes, business as usual. And mine are pretty much the same, another straightforward weekend, nothing new from Red Bull, on track at least.
Yeah, I think it's a very strong weekend from them. They've been able to continue on from last year's, despite, you know, big changes to their car concept. And I think it's nice to see that Perez is looking stronger and a bit up there too.
When it comes to Ferrari, though, Timo's note is, again, a relatively short one, but it makes a good point. Main title contender for 2024 at this rate. Excellent from Behrmann. And I think he's right in Ferrari could go for the championship as a constructor this year. I wouldn't be surprised if it happens if Leclerc and Sainz are able to consistently outperform Perez. They could really start nibbling into Red Bull's championship hopes there, and it will be very interesting to see. And certainly when it comes to Behrmann, I think we all were sort of holding our breaths. We all were David Behrmann through that entire race weekend, sort of going the entire time, because it was close, but it was a really good drive from Charles, I'll say, especially against the better brace of cars. Put up a good fight against the Red Bulls, and the drive from Ollie was exactly what we wanted to see. It was really competent, it was promising, it was just racy enough. He did exactly what the engineers needed him to do to sort of bring it home, and worked his way through the field, picked off the cars ahead of him, and made it work.
Yeah, I mean, Leclerc was sort of the best of the rest, really. He could do, it was sort of the best he could really do, and I'll sort of get on to Behrmann a bit later, but I think it was a cracking performance from him. And I just loved how throughout the whole duration of the race, his strategist was basically like, "You're doing amazing, sweetie.
You're doing amazing, sweetie." Also, Carlos Sainz is here. Say hi, Carlos. Hi. And he was also on the radio as well, which I really like. And sort of, I think Charles got lucky with this because he didn't have Carlos to race against. It would have been interesting to see which Ferrari driver would have come out on top, but I think we'll get that answer in Australia. So we'll move on from Ferrari to Mercedes, who, yeah, Timo's note is disappointing again and hoping they can make some steps forward soon. And I'm a bit more sort of cup half full for Mercedes. I think they're up against it fighting McLaren and Aston Martin. So it's going to be interesting to see how they develop across the year. And certainly because my brain is technical and like seeing sort of mechanical things change and make the monkey go hoo-hee-ha. I'm looking to see which circuits start to really favour the Mercedes and which ones don't. And then sort of trying to figure out sort of which way they're developing their car, certainly against the likes of the Aston Martin and McLaren, which also use their engines and power units. So it's an interesting technical battle between those three. And I think Mercedes had a good stab at it this weekend, but ultimately they weren't able to extract quite the same level of pace. And it's interesting which way the confidence in the car is sliding. It's certainly going more towards Russell than it is Hamilton.
Yeah, that's sort of kind of what my notes are on. I think at the moment we're seeing that Russell seems to be able to get a bit more out of that car at the moment than Hamilton. Obviously, both were too close to each other to double stack during the safety car period, so Hamilton got left out, but I think he was able to keep those medium tyres working very well to keep Piastri behind him, sort of on a fresh set of hard tyres. But I would say they're about fourth, fifth fastest this weekend, and that's not where they want to be.
There's scope for them to improve. When it comes to the people they're fighting closely, McLaren, Timo says Piastri with a brilliant drive and keeping his head down, even if Hamilton frustrated him for a good while there. And I'll say certainly on Piastri, I'll get to him in good measure actually, but it's not a bad weekend for Norris. Struggling to get through traffic, the jump start was a bit of a mistake. Strange that it wasn't penalised, but I did sort of do a bit of digging into this, and this is because of the way the FIA transponders work. The transponder itself didn't detect motion, and the transponder is God above all. So if the transponder says didn't move, it didn't move, even if it's blatantly obvious on the video. So Lando got very lucky there, but had a fairly sound recovery drive, nothing too flamboyant, just again bringing home the points that really keeps McLaren in the fight in the constructors this year and keeps him in the right half of the field when it comes to driver's points. So we'll get to Piastri in good time for me.
I know it's a bit controversial, but I actually think they made the right decision not to penalise Norris, because in my mind, you should only get penalised if you've gained a lasting advantage and it actually it actually hampered him. So I think it's kind of fair.
Yeah, in the end of it, he was slow getting off the line because he sort of stopped, braked, and as everyone sort of left, he was like, oh shit, I had to sort of get back going again. So there wasn't an advantage he gained from that. It's sort of like the going off track thing. If you don't gain a lasting advantage, you don't get the 10-second penalty for it. So it's sort of fine. You just sort of get black and white for track limits, which is reasonable. And we can give the FIA points for being reasonable in this case.
Yeah, definitely. And Piastri, he had a very good weekend. You know, I think last year, you know, he was obviously a rookie and his racecraft was what slightly held him back, but it looks like he's learned a lot and he's been able to use that to race better this year so far. And I think the main thing was McLaren really struggling with their straight line speed. They weren't feeling the effects of DRS as strongly as most of the other teams, which hurt them when trying to make an overtake. Do you think that was kind of a setup issue or something more integral to the car design?
I'd say certainly for this circuit, that could well have been a DRS sort of setup thing. I'd say this could be sort of not dialing out as much rear wing as they needed. They seemed pretty on it through a lot of the turns. They were able to sort of fight well and grip well. And that was sort of telling that they had a lot of downforce coming off those wings, but they just sort of weren't able to, certainly at the rear, bleed off as much as they might have wanted to. Maybe the drivers wanted a really sticky rear end just to really fire it through the tight turns and just sort of battle the understeer as they went along. So it's, I think that's more of a setup thing than a major sort of issue to keep an eye on. But there is the shot of, I think it's Perez coming past one of the McLarens and it just blitzes past. You're like, oofed. I know the Red Bull's quick, but the McLaren was struggling for straight line speed there. The other team struggling in general, I think it's fair to say, was Aston Martin this weekend. Timo's note is Alonso being Alonso and Stroll being Stroll, which I think is a bit reductive. But ultimately, there is nothing really exceptional there. Alonso was just doing Alonso things, a very competitive, very sort of competent drive from him. And Stroll, being reminded that the wall's here, I think it's easy enough for anyone to make that mistake. You're trying to trim your lines. You're trying to get the most out of the circuit. And it's going to happen to one of them. I think it's just unfortunate it happened to Stroll. He's pushing hard. He is against a world champion teammate in a competitive car. He's got to start looking good because, again, people are going to be judging him otherwise. My main concern is the fact that when he makes the second contact, when he's sort of broken the track rod, and noses into the barrier, he's still got his hands on that wheel as he goes in. And I know that it's racing driver instinct to fight it till the last, but you also see a lot of racing drivers that sort of do the very sensible thing where, and this is going to make no sense because it's an audio medium, but they just sort of cross their hands, just grab the braces and hold on. Because, you know, if you're going in hard, you don't want to be holding onto a wheel that's going to start bucking and writhing in your hands, especially if last season you broke your wrists before the year started. And you could be a little bit fragile if you've got a wrist that's pinned together. So, hopefully no major injuries there. It might just be a bit of bruising, might be a bit sore, but he seemed properly gutted when he came away from that one. Like I think he knew where the error from that one came, and I don't think it needs dwelling on anymore. I think he's wholly aware on that one. And certainly when you heard the voice message over the radio to Brad, his engineer, when he said, "Can you bring the car home?" He went, "No, I'm in the wall." You're like,
I don't really have much more to add, to be honest. It's long as it's a pretty strong weekend, and like track one wrong move and you're in the wall.
Yeah, as we saw. Speaking of wrong moves though, we'll go to RB, and Timo's note simply says, "At least we know they didn't copy Red Bull," which is true. The performance deficit was very obvious this weekend. Yuki had a tough drive. I don't think anything really went right for RB this weekend, but this was sort of a relatively clean drive for Yuki and competitive. Even the unsafe release, which not really his fault, so there's nothing to really apologise on his side from there, had a pretty good race time by the end of it. DR3, though, it was messy for Danny Rick. Doesn't help that he was impacted by a bad stop. It was about 40 seconds. So he was pushing hard to catch up with the rest of the field and then spun on his own with Perez watching from behind. This was as Perez was coming around to lap him. As Perez enters, I think it's turn one, he can see Danny Rick just going around on his lonesome. And you, if you're Perez at that point, you're going to be buoyed with optimism because there's the guy that's supposed to be replacing you spinning while not fighting anyone. And if you're Danny Rick, there's the guy you're passing or supposed to be replacing about to lap you and you're spinning. So it's a great weekend morally for Yuki Tsunoda, I think, from that standpoint. But there is, as much as I'd like to sort of add fuel to the Danny Rick fire, I think this is the wrong weekend to try and do that. He was really screwed over with a 40-second stop. So, yeah.
I think it's perhaps a, I think it's a better car than last year, but neither driver has yet really delivered enough, I don't think. I think there was an opportunity for both drivers in both the races we've had where they could have been nearer to fighting for points. I don't necessarily think that's all on the driver. It has been a bit on the team as well, as a whole. But when we do look at Daniel Ricciardo, you know, and Red Bull took him back, Christian Horner sort of said he's picked up some bad habits and he's not really the Ricciardo that they know. And it was hard for him to really unlearn those things last year because obviously he broke his wrist. And I'm wondering how much of these bad habits or his confidence is really affecting him, because obviously they saw something in Ricciardo during that test in Silverstone last year that showed he still has that talent in him. You know, they said he would have been next to Verstappen for the race with one of the laps that he put in. And subsequently, they dropped a free spin season for him. Red Bull really have done a lot for Ricciardo. And I know it's early in the season. He did have an awful stop. And it was, you know, it was long enough that we were able to have a conversation about whether he was retiring the car or just changing tyres. But I think as well, we do need to start seeing something soon.
Yeah, he's got to start giving. He's got to start showing that he's getting rid of those bad habits, or really start outperforming Yuki Tsunoda to prove that it was worth ruining another driver's career for.
Yeah.
You've got to view it, if you're going to view it completely holistically, you've got to bear in mind that Nyck de Vries's F1 career was trashed by this. Like, we haven't seen him around the paddock since. We haven't seen him as a reserve driver or a test driver. He's shuttled off back to Formula E and been pretty quiet since. I don't know if he's still linked to any F1 teams, if he's sort of still got that contract with Mercedes, but that's, yeah, there is, at the end of the day, on Red Bull, I don't want to say this is on Danny Rick, but on Red Bull's shoulders, what they did to him. And I know Red Bull are ruthless when it comes to their drivers. Look at the way they treated Daniel Kvyat. But, yeah, things to look at. Meanwhile, over in Williams, Timo's written, Albon's overtake on Tsunoda has to be an early contender for best of the year. Meanwhile, Kevin Magnussen's overtake on, or well, Albon's attempted overtake on Kevin Magnussen has to go in for worst. And Kevin Magnussen did earn a 10-second penalty for essentially putting Albon into the wall at one point, which I think is fair. Albon found some really good pace in the car this weekend, and Logan was looking a lot more at home in it, especially on a very demanding, challenging circuit. So he was up there challenging those around him, making some defensive moves, trying to get past in places. A few more races on easier to explore circuits and he'll be on fine form. Post Suzuka, I reckon we'll have a tidy Logan on the go. Like, Miami will be a different race for him, and I'm excited for that. This is, for me, this is signs of things to come. There, it's not a great race for Williams, but it's one that proves that there is something cooking.
They couldn't really do much, could they? As obviously Magnussen held them up. But
Magnussen is a fantastic defender. This is the other half of the thing that Haas can look after its tyres now. And they've gone, oh, great, we've figured out what our strategy is. In the same way that Williams figured out their strategy was just run Alex as long as possible, then pit him at the last moment, Haas have gone, well, we'll just form a train behind Kevin and pit Nico ahead of that. That's going to work as a strategy. And sure as dumb luck has it, it did.
Yes. And Albon, I mean, he did. He was, you could tell the frustration in him because he was getting real punchy at moments and there were good, bold overtakes from him.
Mm. Like, really sending it, which again speaks for the confidence he's got in that car and the fact that there is a good chassis that's coming out underneath it. And I reckon once Logan finds that and finds how to drive it within a few races where he's at circuits he's more comfortable at, where you can explore the limits a bit more without it just immediately being a wall and pain, I think we could see a very interesting team dynamic moving forwards from there, and certainly a few more points. Flip side of that coin of positivity and optimism. Stake, Sauber, Timo's written, learn how to do pit stops, and I will agree with him on this one. Points for effort, though, for getting Zhou out in qualifying. I really like this. Even if it was a little, too late, they sort of got the car rebuilt after a fairly nasty shunt in FP3. Final few sort of 2 minutes of Q1, Zhou's back in the car. They've literally gaffer-taped bits of it together, put him out. He doesn't quite make it past the line ahead of the checkered flag, so doesn't get a chance to go for a time, given what Bottas was able to produce. I don't think it was really worth it. But it's lovely to see the old school drive from the team and them really trying proper spirit of the sport stuff. If you were to sort of give a trophy for optimistic moment of the year, I think that would probably be an early contender. But another ballsed up pit stop undid a lot of it, though. They both seem to have issues this weekend coming into the pits, and it's definitely a wheel nut issue that's throwing a spanner in the works each time. I think we'll see an update on this later in the season, maybe Imola, possibly as early as Miami. I think it really depends on which bit of freight they can get things out for. Hell, they might have new nuts on the way out to Australia. There'll be someone carrying them in hand luggage on the way out. The old school Formula One way of, oh, you're going out to this race. Here, take this. Insert sort of rear wing, front wing element, side pod, something in your hand luggage.
Never mind the like 20 kilogram weight limit.
It's F1. Everything's lightweight, isn't it? Like, it's a set of wheel nuts. How much can a set of wheel nuts weigh? And if Stake are making wheel nuts that weigh more than 20 grams per set on a car, that's where the problem is. Your wheel nuts weigh more than a border collie. Like, there's your problem. Start making it out of something lighter than, I don't know, rubidium.
I mean, I basically just, well, agree with Timo's sentiments. This is two races in a row now that they've just had poor pit stops. I mean, and you've also got to think, Zhou was on the same strategy as Hülkenberg too. So I would have told him to give it everything he had to maximize on Haas's strategy and get ahead of the Magnussen train. But they left him out too long to optimize any of it.
We saw a similar strategy failure in Formula 2. If you watched Juan Manuel Correa's race, which was a case of leave him out on the firmer compound tyre and pit him last minute. They had a safety car moment where they could have pitted him and come out with points, but they didn't. They pitted him way too late and in the end had to make the mandatory pit stop under green flag conditions. As a result, he lost a load of places and fell out of the points. Like this, it happened several times across the series in Formula One this weekend. And this is possibly telling for how much she's sort of reappeared in the media a bit recently. She was on checkered flag, she was on pit stop. Ruth Buscombe would have never let that happen while she was at Sauber. And this is case for point for paying attention to Formula 2, because there is a lot to be learned from it, certainly in how to not organise a race strategy. Alfa Romeo just cocked that one up, pure and simple, and then capitalised on it by having bad pit stops when they did pit their drivers.
It wasn't great, was it?
But speaking of good, certainly Haas's pit stops, which I'll get to in a second. Timo's written, excellent teamwork to get to a point on the board, and despite K-Mag's antics, he left everyone behind him for dust once his job was done. Pleasant surprise. And I have to say, again, I'm going to agree with Timo. It was really, really mature and technical drive from Haas. Interesting strategy, and the performance of the car puts it around the tail end of the points by the look of things. So they're sort of combining its ability to run on its tyres properly and sort of putting that with its average pace and a good strategy to actually figure out how to get points. It's quite nice. If they keep it up, we could be in for an interesting season of them pinching points, Williams pinching points as they go. It's really going to be an interesting fight at the bottom between RB and Alpine and Stake as Williams and Haas sort of run away from them, sniping the odd point here and there. And I think credit really has to go to their pit crew for a very good pit stop with Hülkenberg. Obviously the pressure on the team, knowing that we need to do Hülkenberg when he comes in, it's got to be quick to get him out ahead of the Magnussen train. It was a good stop. Clean, tidy. It wasn't the fastest in the world. It was 2 point something, I think. But it was exactly what they needed, and they've got a team that's operating within that window now. They've got a team that can do those things and make those strategies and make those decisions and pull off the pit stops. all the right things are starting to fall into place for Haas to start becoming competitive again. I think overall they stand somewhere like fifth, sixth in the standings at the moment. So it's paying off for them. Where do they stand? Sixth. Yeah.
Yeah, I pretty much agree. I think this weekend shows some real promise from them. You know, obviously the strategy to get Magnussen to keep everyone else behind him and back them up to allow a big enough gap to let Hülkenberg pit and come out ahead to get that point in the championship. They couldn't have done that without having the car underneath them. I know that this is a low deck circuit, but last year, if they had tried that strategy with how poorly that Haas could look after its tyres, one, Hülkenberg probably would have fallen back into that pack, and two, Magnussen would have not been able to keep those drivers behind him. And then, you know, once Hülkenberg did pit, Magnussen was able to pull out a good gap ahead of the train behind them. This is really positive from looking at, you know, of where they were last year.
It's definitely the step forward we want to see from Haas. And when it comes to the season-long race, it's going to be very interesting. I think the one team that didn't make the step forward we wanted to see this weekend was Alpine. And Timo's note is 4 or 5 words long. And it's, Christ, that car is ugly. I mean, you didn't see much of it this weekend because one of them retired pretty much immediately, which was gearbox issues from Gasly's car. But I think for me, this suggests there's a lot more of a problem built into this car than we initially anticipated. If they're suffering with gearbox problems, if they're suffering with the performance on track, there is something fundamentally misunderstood about this car, and it's going to be a big uphill battle for them to try and develop out of it, because things like gearbox failures after one race is not what you expect from a team that is a mainstream constructor as well. This isn't like they don't understand what they're putting together. This is their gearbox. This is their engine. It's not like they've made it for someone else or bought it from someone else. They should know the exact working elements of this, and they've already fritzed one of their biggest and most expensive elements. This isn't a good look. And you extrapolate that across the rest of a car, I've got major concerns. Ocon, though, mid-performance given the tools. I think this is ultimately bad luck for Gasly, but Ocon did his best to try and pull it back. But there's only so many weekends he can walk away being optimistic on the radio. I think eventually that team is going to run into a serious, serious issue. And contract retentions are going to be tricky. And if you're Ryan Reynolds, you're possibly also looking at getting your money out of that investment pot.
Gasly is in 21st in a 20-driver lineup. And that's, I have no more to add on the situation.
So we'll move into our winners and spinners. And we'll start with Timo's, who has again left us some notes, and he's gone winner, Kevin Magnussen. Harsh penalties, but interesting talking point for another day. And Ablano, I think that's supposed to say Albon, deserves another shout out for that overtake in unlikely place on track. And I think he's definitely right there. Albon and Magnussen, interesting races, really battling against sort of results that came their way when it comes towards penalties or one of the other ones driving them into the wall. So, credit there. Ellie May, we'll go for your winner, please.
I've gone for Ollie Bearman. And I hate watching the race in Saudi Arabia, like I've already said earlier on. At the best of times, it puts me on edge with how close they get to the wall. And I think this race was just made all the worse because I really wanted Bearman to do well. And he did really prove himself. He came into this situation with such a calm head, performed really well. Saudi is not an easy track to get to drive around, and neither is that Ferrari to drive, really. And it just shows how such a solid performance that he had was fantastic. And I feel a bit sorry for him because he did obviously get pole in F2 and he's potentially lost out on some good points there. But getting points in your first F1 race with a little practice is a much more impressive outcome. He showed a lot of practice, He showed a lot of promise in the free practice sessions last year too. So hopefully with a good season in F2 this year, we will see him in Formula One next year. But I do feel like we have this conversation about a few drivers who have shown talent but never got that opportunity to have a permanent F1 seat. You know, you look at the performance Liam Lawson put in last year, you've got the likes of Felipe Drugovich too, now Ollie Bearman. And my question is, we always say F1 is a cutthroat sport, but should it be more cutthroat? Because there are a few drivers where they've been in F1 for a few seasons now, and their driving is okay, but I don't see them having that sort of spark in them where I think we would see them win a championship. So really, should we be saying sort of bye to them and letting fresh, potentially amazing talent go?
So you're saying Bottas, Hulkenberg, Magnussen, Stroll, if you're going to name a few of them?
I will still remain that put Hulkenberg in a good car, but I think Bottas's days are over.
Bottas's days aren't over. Bottas, again, I think much the same as Hulkenberg, you put him in a good car. The problem is Bottas has always run the problem of, oh, my teammate is Lewis Hamilton. Perfect.
I think with Bottas, the problem is now I view him almost like Kimi Raikkonen in that he went to Alfa Romeo to retire.
Retire, yes. Yeah, and Bottas has very much leaned into that, though. So I think he knows he's going to be there to sort of do a few more bits, get a comfortable enough paycheck to live off the sort of interest of it each month, and then just sort of maybe do a bit of work here and there.
But then if that's sort of my point, if you know if you're kind of there thinking this is sort of, it's more of a hobby.
Yeah.
Why are you?
Let Ollie Behrman come in. Bring me my Kimi Antonelli on a silver platter. Give me my Felipe Drugovich, my Callum Ilott, my Marcus Armstrongs that have gone off and found other series to be good at as well, I should add. Like Callum Ilott has been called up to McLaren in IndyCar and he did a decent-ish job this weekend. Romain Grosjean knew his time was up, moved on and opened up that seat, admittedly has then filled it with two rookies, one of which was completely useless, which has almost sort of scared people away from hiring rookies. We thought Williams were being a bit out there when they hired Logan Sargeant. So there's been a swing in public perception of it, but I think the ultimate argument is when you look at probably the oldest Formula One grid we've had since the 50s, like the cumulative or the average age for the field is certainly getting up there, especially when you look at Fernando Alonso, you look at Hamilton, who's turning 40 soon, you look at the fact that Perez and Ricciardo aren't exactly spring chickens either.
34 and 33, I think.
Yeah. Like in F1 world, that is
old.
Getting old. Yeah. Like gone are the days when you could Damon Hill it, rock up into the series age 24 or 25 and go, yo, I'm going to start F1 and be like, cool. That used to be normal. You used to be able to be Juan Manuel Fangio at 52 winning world championships. You can't be that now, and that's a shame. Or was it Farina that was 52 and winning? I can't remember.
Fangio.
Yeah, you can't be in your 50s winning championships these days. That's a shame.
It's weird because it's almost like you kind of had more sort of what you would classify as your older drivers, and then we went really, really young. With the likes of like Verstappen, Leclerc, then like a year later you have like Norris and Russell coming in, and you know Stroll is
he was the youngest driver to ever enter F1. Yeah, like
yeah. And now it's almost getting back to the where we have had so many young, good talent come in.
Mm.
It's now that it's everyone's sort of the grid's getting older again.
Yeah, and we've sort of stuck in that waiting phase, waiting for the grid to get old enough to go off and have kids and leave sort of thing. Like you look at Vettel, sort of did his time, had his championships, and then left.
Yeah, and I think Ollie Behrman might just be at the right age. Mm-hmm. That there may be a few seats coming up next year.
He's still linked with Haas. He's still got test drives with Haas through this year in FP1 sessions. And crucially, he's doing six of them this year. It's not just like he's doing the mandated two. I think that Haas link with the Ferrari engine, crucially, he is a Ferrari Junior Academy driver, it's keeping him close. And I think Haas have got a long-term plan when it comes to their drivers and sort of going, we can't have Magnussen and Hulkenberg here forever. And Ferrari are going, we can't have Charles Leclerc and Lewis Hamilton here forever. Would you guys mind training Ollie Behrman to drive F1 every weekend? And it's heading that way. But yeah, Behrman is a refreshing taste of the future to come. My winner is Oscar Piastri. Really solid weekend of it. Really tidy drive. Refused to over-push it as well and brought home a solid dose of points for McLaren. This is a reformed driving style, especially when you compare him to 12 months ago. The sort of overdriving, tire chewing mistakes we were seeing from Piastri are completely gone. This is the sort of thing we want to see from Danny Ric, as a driver that reforms and changes and works to the team and the car he's supplied with. Piastri's learned to do that, and he learned to do that in half a season. Like, you look at his driving towards the tail end of last year, was worlds apart from the way he started. We're now looking at that through like the 12-month prism, and it is good. It is the step forward we wanted to see him make. And if we want to see a Piastri World Championship contention, when that McLaren sort of properly hits the ground running in 26, that's going to be interesting. Especially if he's not rivaled by Norris, who might have moved to Audi.
Who knows?
Who knows? Anyway, we'll move on to our spinners. And Ellie May, I'll start with yours, please.
I've gone for Stroll because... how many times are you going to crash on a street circuit, man? I mean, I know Saudi Arabia is a horrible track, and it is kind of unfortunate in that it wasn't like a spectacular of misjudgment, but come on. You've been in this sport long enough to know better.
I think the worst part is that he's done a relatively rookie mistake on a weekend where Behrmann's in one of the Ferraris, yeah, and you're against F1 Academy. Drivers that have never turned a competitive lap around this circuit. And so many of them looked immediately at home there. Like Dorian Powell and Abby Pulling, worlds apart from the rest of their field. I know we'll talk about them when we come to do like our sort of quarterly recap on feeder series. But ignoring the strange moment, they didn't really bother making it clear the race had ended, which penalised Dorian Powell after the second race in W Series, or F1 Academy even. Like, it... their driving, their ability put to shame Stroll and certainly a few of the other drivers in F1, dare I say, maybe Sargeant, maybe Joe Bottas and Danny Ric, my spinner. But yeah.
It's just, I mean, how long has he been in this sport now, really?
Stroll, what, he joined 2016, didn't he?
I think so.
Because he's...
no, what, 25th? Same year as Verstappen?
What, did he join 14?
Or Verstappen 2015?
Lance Strulovich joined Formula One in 2017. Really? Wow.
Yeah, he must have, because if he was 18.
He's same age, he's same year as you, but
same year as me. Yeah.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And so he joined a year after Verstappen. Verstappen is the same year as me, so that makes sense as to why they're sort of both about 18 when they joined, or 16 when they joined. So we've given Timo spinner, you've given your spinner, my spinner is Danny Ric. Not a great looking weekend when Yuki was way up the road in qualifying and on track and then spinning on your own while hunting down Logan Sargeant. Phrase it that way, it's rough. Admittedly, yeah, there was the 40-second pit stop in there, but you should have been in a better situation to begin with. You should have been up there in qualifying, especially if you are the guy that's going to be replacing Perez. Got to start qualifying up there then, buddy. Only reason he's as far up in the standings is his countback trick from Bahrain. Like, it's already paying off when you look at how they stand in the championships. Where are they on my list? Tsunoda 18th, Ricciardo 16th. Neither has scored points yet, but because of the way that Danny Ric got ahead in countback in Bahrain, means that despite a rough weekend in Saudi, he's still ahead. Fun times there. We'll move on from our winners and spinners to our predictions, where there's a fair amount of points up for grabs this week. Ellie May, you got a clean sweep of the podium, 3 points for you. Very well done. I get a point for Verstappen pole and Verstappen P1. Timo gets one for Perez P2. Do I not get any other ones? I surely must have got more than that. I can't have predicted it that badly.
Well, so Carlos Sainz is one of yours.
Yeah.
So that's already good.
Yeah. Sainz P2 and fastest lap and Perez P3. Ugh, yeah. Double stake points was clearly a long shot there.
It was better than mine.
Better than yours, which was both Aston Martin's finish ahead of Mercedes, which was... one of the Aston Martins didn't even finish.
Yeah.
It finished the race ahead of the Mercedes, as in its racing was done before the Mercedes. So if we wanted to spin it, could offer your points there. But I won't. When it comes to our fantasy F1 teams, though, John Steeler's Take a Stroll remains the highest scoring team this week. His second team, What's the Racing Point, was second, with Lecress in third this week. My highest scoring team was Jaffa Cake Racing in P7. Ellie May, your best was the podcast team in P14. But a huge congratulations to the greatest moustache, the greatest moustache, for scoring 0 points. Really impressive you achieved that.
Well, so in my team, this is how bad it is. I've got Valtteri Bottas, who, because obviously he has the best facial hair.
He has the double
points thing.
Yeah.
So he got -1, which meant that doubled to -2. Lance Stroll then got -17 points, and Pierre Gasly -20.
Completely undid all the work of Alonso, Aston Martin and Williams, scoring 16, 9 and 14 points respectively. Danny Ric, though, playing it fair, scored nothing at all.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, how did he end up with nothing at all? He got 2 points for a race overtake bonus, but also lost 2 places, so -2 there.
Yeah. So, I'm not changing them, but it is based on facial hair, but my main extra magnifico terrestri has had major overhaul. So
what, since this week, since Saudi?
Yes,
because in Saudi it was running Verstappen, Alonso, Albon, Joe, Ricciardo.
Ricciardo's gone. I think Joe might be gone. No, Joe might be there. McLaren are gone.
Oh,
Alonso's gone.
Oh, she's making changes. She's playing the game this year. She's really going all in on making these changes. She's taking it seriously. She takes her predictions. Yeah.
I can't do that badly. Come on.
Overall, though, in the Fantasy League standings, Take a Stroll still leads with What's the Racing Point and Lecress in second and third. My Jaffa Cake Racing is up to 8th overall, and my girlfriend's Tall Boy 3 moves up to P10. Ellie May, your highest overall remains the podcast team in P15, down from last week. So,
like I said, there's a major...
major upgrades coming in the LMA Fantasy Formula 1 world, which is a perfect point to leave us on as we move towards the Australian Grand Prix, and it's all we've got time for on this week's episode, which at time of recording is an hour and 40 minutes long. I will be cutting bits out of this so you don't have to listen to this for quite that long. But anyway, if you would like more from us, not necessarily the bits I've cut out, they'll be cut for good reason. Where can the people find you, LMA?
They can find me on our Instagram page, where I'm doing sort of an exciting mini series, sort of looking at all the women who paved the way in motorsport and are still paving the way in motorsport.
Yeah, it's a very good series. The first edition is out at the moment, and it is a very good, well-researched, well-designed read. In fact, this is one that's entirely off your back and is better for it, I'd say, for not having the interference of myself and Timo in it. So, it's worth going and finding us on Instagram, giving us a like, follow, subscribe, and all the usual stuff on our social media feeds, as well as on Spotify and YouTube. In the meantime, if you'd like more from me, you can find me across social media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok as @JesseOnCars. I do have YouTube channels. I haven't posted anything meaningful to them in at least 2 years. It does give me a great chance to remind you to pick up a copy of Classic Car Weekly. Our latest issue will be out not long after this goes live. We're offering the top buying tips for mid-engined fun on any price from £1,000 to over £100,000. So worth picking up for that, just to hear my thoughts on the W10 Toyota MR2. Really fun little car. And of course, thank you to our listeners in Cape Town, South Africa. It's been too long since I was last there, and I'd love to come back sometime soon. In the meantime, feel free to send over a case of something refreshing from the Devil's Peak Beer Company. We do genuinely have listeners from Cape Town. I looked it up on our like Spotify statistics, which is quite fun. Southern Hemisphere enjoyers of the Undercut podcast. They might be British listeners on holiday. They might just be South African fans of Formula One that found us an entertaining podcast, which is quite a far-fetched concept. Anyway, we'll be back in due course with a preview for the Australian Grand Prix. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again soon.